Good morning, everybody, and first of all, I would like to thank Philip Goyle, which is not here, I think. But the other organizers, and in addition, for inviting an outsider like me. I'm not a physicist, I'm a statistician, but I've been interested in physics, and what I will start with now is to have a short look at this title. The important word here is steps. That means that I do not claim to have any complete theory. I only will give some steps. And it also means that I am open for the fact that some of you might disagree with the steps that I'm making. So I'm open towards changing my steps perhaps, but I have an idea that in some way we should reach together a unison from unified basis. And also, as Lucian said, this title is an abbreviation for steps towards the unified basis for scientific models and methods. And this is a big project that hopefully will appear soon. And if some of you should be very impatient, a preliminary version is on the web here. So here is my point of departure. In this small world, there are different cultures across time and space in all eras of human endeavor. Religion, politics, ethnic groups, art, professions, and so on, and I think also in science. There exist different cultures in science across time. People had different beliefs 100 years ago than they have today, and across space, which means across different eras of research. So if you really take this serious, so we can ask the question, can we have really objective science? And maybe we can, to the extent that we can translate languages and learn from each other. And what I want to discuss is two eras of research, mathematical statistics and quantum theory. And as all of you know, in quantum theory, most of the literature is based on framework where states are represented by unit vectors in a complex Hilbert space. Well, that's not completely true, but it's a beginning. And in mathematics, in mathematical statistics, most of the literature is based on a framework given by parametric classes of probability measures. This word parametric classes is very important. Statisticians think in terms of parameters. And parameters are indices for classes of probability measures, or probability distributions. It's somewhat similar to what Ariel Kattikat talked about on Sunday, where he had probability distributions as variables. Statisticians would also have probability distributions as variables, but they index these variables, these probability distributions, by their parameters. So the parameters are what they talk about, what they make inference about, and they estimate the parameters, make hypothesis about parameters. This has been some talk about Bayesian statistics, and in statistics we really have Bayesians in terms of parameters. We have prior sonar parameters and we have posterior sonar parameters. And other concepts in quantum theory, like Fisher information, is also in terms of parameters. So the parameter, the indices of the probability distributions are very central. Also from a practical point of view, in agricultural statistics, in medical statistics, and so on. Everything is in terms of parameters. And we have two bases here, and each has led to a very rich and varied structure. But the question remains, can one find connections here? And then I will start about saying something about completeness. As I said, mathematical statistics has linked to very many different empirical sciences. Medical sciences, agriculture, social sciences, and so on. But we still can ask, to which extent can this mathematical basis be considered to be complete? And one way of discussing this question is to take in a topic from mathematical logic, where Gödel's incompleteness theorem says that in every rational logical system, one can ask questions which cannot be answered within the same system. And that applies to mathematical statistics also. So we can imagine that we have a richer theory, a richer area of research, then we can ask more questions and more get more answers. So I will extend mathematical statistics. I want extend it in two directions. The first direction is focusing, and the second direction is symmetry. Focusing means that we have something which is more general than parameters, which I call C variables, phi, which do not have any values. But components of the phi have values. So we can focus on components of such an abstract C variable and ask questions about these components of theta. I will give some examples. Symmetry is more well known. It's done by imposing a symmetry group on the parameters of the model. Or we can start with a group on the C variables, space phi. And these two extensions will later be coupled to quantum mechanics. And as I said, by only analogy of Gödel, the extended concept system is not complete, but more questions can now be asked and answered within the system. So let's give some examples of this focusing concept. Imagine that you have one medical patient, and we are interested in the expected lifetime of this single medical patient. This expected lifetime is lambda 1 if you get treatment 1, and it's lambda 2 if you get treatment 2. And he will receive one of these two treatments. And expected should be taken in terms of what the medical expertise expects to take into account knowledge to have of the patient. So the parameter and the two parameters, lambda 1 and lambda 2, come first. And that's the way statisticians think. The parameters come first, and the model comes later. But taken together, then, these two parameters, lambda 1 and lambda 2, cannot be estimated. The single patient cannot be given both treatment 1 and treatment 2. He can only be given one of these treatments. So the vector lambda 1, lambda 2 is a C variable phi. But we can focus on one of the components, lambda 1 or lambda 2. That is, we can choose treatment 1 and focus on lambda 1, or we can choose choose treatment 2 and focus upon treatment last time, lambda 2. And this can be generalized. In many experimental settings, you have a vector view. Several lambdas, and you can only estimate one of the lambdas. This is a C variable. And you estimate one of the lambdas, and the rest are called counterfactuals. And these counterfactuals are also important in other cases than statistical experiments. There's a large literature on causal reasoning. It's a famous book by Pearl, and there are many papers on this. Let's look at a smaller example, a more specific example of focusing. An apparatus has a very specious, for a very special length measurement, is so sensitive that it is destroyed after one single measurement. And that mu, that's the parameter mu, with the length which is to be measured. And I assume furthermore that the measurement uncertainty sigma only can be estimated by destroying the whole apparatus. And sigma is another parameter. But when we look now upon the vector mu sigma, it's impossible in this apparatus to estimate the whole C variable phi. Only one of the parameters mu and sigma can be estimated. Yes?
You said measurement uncertainty. Do you mean spread in a statistical ensemble?
Yes. Yes.
But you say it can only be measured by destroying the whole apparatus. It seems to me that the apparatus can only be used once, and there's no way to estimate the measurement uncertainty.
Yes, so this is an abstract concept. We can imagine this uncertainty as a parameter without having a possibility to realize repeated measurements. So it's just an abstract concept of uncertainty in this case.
So you're thinking of sigma as something like the variance of the Gaussian?
Yeah.
You have a statistical model that has a certain mean and the
variance. Right.
So it can be Gaussian.
Yeah, it can be Gaussian.
And the idea is that a single shot measurement reveals something about the mean or the variance.
Right.
Not necessarily revealing it itself, but.
Yes, you can't know everything.
So, I think then, what I understand is that one measurement would give you some information about both these things, the mean and the variance. But it seems to me you're describing that you sort of have a choice, a counterfactual choice. Either I can find out about mu, or I can find out about sigma. But I don't really see how a measurement, like if you use one, but what would you do differently if you say, well, I want to focus on finding out about sigma, as opposed to if you want to focus on finding out about mu?
Well, here concretely, you have two possibilities. Either you perform a measurement and let the answer be mu, or you destroy the whole apparatus and not some reading in this telling you something about the apparatus will give you the parameter sigma. You have choice between two experiments, but you can't perform both. But anyway, this is a very artificial example. So, but here you have only one apparatus. So the thing is just an abstraction. What you can imagine is that you have some label inside the apparatus which you often have in an apparatus. This tells you that the measurement uncertainty for performing measurements for this apparatus is 0.101. But the artificial assumption that I made is that you can only find this label by destroying the whole apparatus.
So the signal through a
cartridge
in the apparatus?
It is a property of the apparatus. Yes. Yes, yeah. Yeah, right. Two different focuses. Yeah. So what I call the C variables in this example is mostly a variable which is that it is impossible to estimate it from the label. This is called inaccessible. But sometimes we are not interested, or we are able to focus, as I said, upon one parameter test or one parameter lambda, if you want, an accessible part of phi, and then look for answers to the question, what is the value of theta? And while you have some relations to quantum mechanics, we have complementarity. Concept physics should not be taken too far, but two questions may be called complementary if they are not, if they are mutually exclusive, that they are part of a common inaccessible variable. They should not be taken too far at this point. But then you have the symmetry, and the symmetry may be introduced by a symmetry group acting on a parameter space and simultaneously on a sample space. Or you can, well, I choose to take the group operator behind what is working on. That is something that is convenient when you come to invariant measures and so on. But here you have a probability distribution indexed by a parameter theta, and you have a G acting upon the sample space, and it turns out that it will give the same as G acting on the theta, taken as a measure of the same A. And there are many examples of group theory and so on. And when you have a group, you can talk about orbits. And the orbits, the set of all parameter values that are transformed for one theta naught. And the whole space is always divided into disjoint orbits. And an orbit is also a minimal invariant set in the group. And in the case where it's only one orbit, this will consist of the whole space theta. But then the group is called transitive. And when you have a group, you also have an invariant measure. Under weak conditions, there exists the right invariant measure having this property. And if theta is compacted, you can take it as a probability measure. Rho is unique in the sense that it can be scaled in a unique way when a parameter group is sensitive. I have seen some very useful example of taking this row as a prior in Bayesian data analysis. One good thing about that is that you get an objective Bayes analysis. And a third parameter is called permissible if lambda theta 1 equals lambda theta 2 implies lambda theta 1 b equals lambda theta 2 b for all b. Later on we will get the situation where this is not valid for all b, but it's valid for a good group of original group. But if then the sub-parameter transforms in the same way as parameter. Then we have model reduction. And this is a practical thing that we have in many statistical cases, that the original model is too large. We have to introduce a smaller model. And one criterion when you have a symmetry group acting from the parameter space is motivated by the fact that the original parameter space is invariant under the group, then we should have that the reduced parameter space should also be an orbit or invariant under the space. So that should be an orbit of a set of orbits for G. So some symmetry of the symmetry path. In many cases, the symmetry group can be introduced in a natural way. There's a group acting upon the sample space and a corresponding group acting upon the parameter space. And in some cases, we introduce the group in a larger C variable space. And it's useful to have a group defined. Now, look upon an example where we still are in a macroscopic setting and where I claim that you will have something of what you have in quantum mechanics and something that seems like an action at a distance, but it's not. You look at the multivariate Latimer model, Z equals TA plus UB. Here A and B are parameters, and T and U are what is called latent variables. But we will treat them in the same setting as parameters. And that means that in this setting, we have a four vector T, A, U, B as a C variable. You can't find all of them at the same time, but we assume that we have measured sets. And we also assume that we have two distant stations. At station one, it's possible to measure T or A, but not both. At station two, it's possible to measure U or B, but not both. So assume that we have measured T in addition to Z. Then we can look at this projector involving T, which is a known projector then. And we can let V be 1 minus T U. Yeah. I'll just. They are matrices, all of them.
So are we doing quantum mechanics with these condition operators?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Then that takes a few of that. So you're saying there's a Venetian operator Z, which is
in this
two Venetian operators T and A.
Yeah.
So T and A commute then. How can I take the product and expect them to be a Venetian operator if they don't commute? And if they do commute, then I should be able to measure both of them.
That they don't commute as matrices, as matrix products, they don't commute. And they are, they have a different nature. This is a random variable, latent variable, and this is a parameter. This is a latent variable, and this is a parameter. So, as matrix products, they don't commute. It's just a classical thing. In fact, it's an example that I learned from chemometrics, from people that are doing this fun things in several dimensions. It's not infinite dimensional operators, it's just matrices.
So where are the matrices coming from? It's not a random variables
are matrices. You can imagine random variables as matrices if you have a spectrum which these geometricians often have. They have a spectrum of observations where these are the observations, and this is a situation where they, for instance, measure the light from a sample of food, and the food consists of several components, protein, and water and whatever components it needs, and each of the components has a spectrum. So you have several spectra like that, and this gives a matrix on the spectra taken together. So you have a resulting set of spectra, and this is decomposed in some parts of the food sample and some other parts of the food sample. Different spectra. No. No, well, Hermitian, they are real vectors. And, Okay, if you operate with 1 minus p here and 1 minus p here, then this thing will disappear, and you get v beta is 1 minus p. And this is a known quantity. So it's a composition of the different spectra for different parts of the food sample, if you want. So in this case, you are able to estimate, in fact, exactly estimate the product VB, and doing some principal component analysis, it means that you get considerable as information about the B. But you don't know much about the U. You know the V here, but not the U. So in this case, you get much information about B, but little information about U. And then by doing a complementary experiment, measuring A, in the same way we got considerable information about U, but B remains largely unknown. Of course, there's no direct action at the distance here, but taking a decision on what to measure station 1, we determine what the parameter to get information on at station 2. This is a very simple thought experiment that can be done to a large extent due to this food sample life experiment. But the focus here is not on the values that O, U, and B are, but it's on what information we can get about U and B. And this may be called a epitaph. You can't know U and B. You can know either B or U. If you, here is the first case where you measure T.
Yes.
Then you can get information about B. In the second case where you measure A, you get information about U. Set is known, yes. Set is known. Understand what you know V, but that is far from knowing U, for this is just a projection in a dip in a. Okay, this has been in terms of statistical experiments or C variables. I think I skipped it. Let us try to get a little closer to quantum mechanics now. Trying to get a statistical model of the electron spin from a statistical point of view. And statistical then means that I have added the concept of focusing and added the concept of symmetry. So we start by modeling angular momentum by a vector, C variable phi. And that, this is a C variable is something that you don't know any value about. So this is just a modeling concept. But we get closer to knowing something not yet, but in a way, by focusing on an angular moment component in some direction A. And then at phi, be given a rotation group. And it turns out that the largest subgroup GA with respect to theta, which theta A is permissible, is given by rotations around an axis A together with reflections in a plane perpendicular to A. So this is a step on the way, but the last step is to introduce a model reduction. The orbits of GA as acting on set A are given by 2-point set plus minus k for some constant k, together with a single point O. So there are many orbits, and they are either 2-point sets or 1-point sets. And I said earlier that the best model reduction is to reduce to one orbit. The maximum model reduction is to reduce to one orbit in this case. So take the non-trivial orbit plus minus one, and let lambda I be a reduced parameter. And then we get something which is accessible. So it's part of a construction, but it is possible to start by a phi, to have a rotation group on this phi, and proceed through the angular momentum in some direction, and take a model reduction on this angular momentum. And then we can say that the state here is a focus question. Given A, what is the lambda, or what the value of this lambda A? And the answers are the lambda A is plus one, lambda A is minus one. So this is equivalent to a Bloch state vector, which is equivalent to an ordinary state vector for electron spin. So in this case, a state is a focus question. We focus upon the lambda A, and we ask what is the value of lambda A, and we get the answer lambda A is either plus one or minus one. Now I will use this to say something about Bell's inequality. Assume that the spin component lambda A and lambda B are measured in a direction given by the unit vectors A and B on two particles at distance sites A and B. And then we have measured values, which are assumed to take values plus minus one. And this is repeated four times, two settings IA dash at site A, and combined with two settings B, B dash at site B. And then I suppose that most of you have been through the fact that you can use a combinatorial argument to show this thing here, this inequality. And similarly, we get the Bell inequality from this, but this is known to be brought in by quantum mechanics and by experiments. Now we want to discuss this derivation from a statistical point of view. And then it's crucial that each of these products have a connection to a different experiment. So we have four different experiments. And in statistics, we have something called the conditional principle, a principle of the fair amount of consensus among statisticians. Then we, in situation where you have several experiments, we should always condition upon the experiment which is actually performed. So from this point of view, there's no reason why you should have the same expectation in all these products. And this is perhaps a very simple argument, but it is a sort of statistical argument than that if you believe in the conditionality principle, then there's no reason to believe in those inequalities. So it's perhaps too simple, but it is a point. So, as the last thing, I start with constructing some quantum space from these assumptions that I have introduced, focusing in symmetry. I consider some C variable phi, I consider a group G, which is assumed to be compact and transitive, and an invariant measure rho. And I focus on some choice A and a reduced parameter lambda A, taking discrete values lambda k. Let dA be the maximum subgroup under which the parameter lambda A is permissible. So you start with a group G and you go to a smaller group, a subgroup PA, connected to the parameter lambda. And of course you can construct a very trivial Hilbert space, the space of all functions of lambda A of phi. It's a subspace of this L2 space, which is well defined. You have the rho, which is the invariant measure defining the L2 space. So you can start by this. And you can also use unitary transformations to transform the L's into a new H space. And my aim is, through a series of theorems, obtain coinciding Hilbert spaces. HA, HB. And the assumptions that I need for this are two. The first is that I can find some group elements GAB in G, transforming the lambda A into the lambda B. And it turns out as a consequence that you can transform the group elements of GB from the group elements of GA. And the second assumption is that these reduced groups generate the whole group G. Then I need something that is well known from mathematics, the right regular representation of G. It's just this representation here. And doing this representation, we can transform the basis vectors of the spaces LA and LB into each other. And when we transform the basis vector of space LA and LB into each other, then we also can transform the HB, which will transform over LB, and we get something like this. And something like this is well known for mathematicians. It's known that every irreducible unitary representation of compact roots can be written in this form. And here is perhaps the main step. I don't go into details. All this is spelled out in detail in an article in Foundations for Physics recently. But it turns out that by fixing some preliminary W naught, the space HA is an invariant space for some abstract group representing D, possibly multivalued, or the whole group G. This is a very brief sketch of a part of the proof. But having this result, then we first have that HA is invariant under this V of GB, and also that the same thing transposes the HA into the HB. So that implies that these two can be made equal, and in the same way the other Hilbert spaces can be made equal. That means that we have one Hilbert space, and this is a step towards quantum mechanics. And in this Hilbert space, we have states and we have operators in the usual way. The states are transforms of the basis vectors in the space that we started with, the LA space. And this basis vector can be interpreted as a focus question: what is lambda A? And the answer, lambda A is lambda K. So again, we can interpret these states as focus questions and an answer. I think I'll skip the part with the self-adjoint operators, except that they, of course, will take this form here. And this form here points at different other interesting quantities that can be defined. Of course, the density operator. The point is that these two quantities have statistical interpretations. The trivial operator or correction operator, VKA, VKA dash, is an operator equivalent to just VKA, which is, in my interpretation, focused question and an answer. So it's an experiment and an experimental value. And then the PK is a probability. So you have probabilities over experiments. And these can be priors or posteriors. And this means that this is connected to some Bayesian quantity. And in the same way here, this effect, as I call it, where I use the density of the experiment here at the value k. Then this is connected to the experiment and the likelihood, what is the thing called the likelihood. And this may be quantum mechanically defined as any self-adjoint operator regimens between 0 and 1. This density can be taken as a probability. This is really discrete, it's not a continuous, so it is a discrete probability taking values between 0 and 1. This is something that I'm going to use in getting one step further, and to get one step further I need to prove Born's formula. And this is proven before in different assumptions, but I want assumptions that are related to statistics. I've never seen any statistical example where this is used, but my point is that I want assumptions that can be formulated in a statistical language. And here is the assumption I want. Transition probabilities exist. The transition probability to an identical state is 1. And these transition probabilities can be transformed by G's, and the things that I need, and the assumption that these things that I get when I transform things are well defined. So to prove this Born formula from these assumptions, I get use a version of Gleason theorem, the Busch-Gleason theorem, where I find that this has again a statistical interpretation to the largest extent. So the theorem says that if you have P of these effects that I defined that are positive, and the crucial thing is that they add when you have effects that add, then they necessarily take this form phrase rho. Or some positive self-adjoint trace one operator rho. Well, again, I won't go into the detailed proof, but the idea is to define a PI from the initial state, lambda equal to lambda k, and into some other state. And then the difficult part of the proof is to prove that you have this addition of the pi. But that is something that you can prove by looking at experiments. So that is the statistical part of the proof. And so you end up with the PIK is of this form, and specializing to the initial values, it implies that the rho must be of this form, and then finally we get the form of them. Born formula. And the consequences of this, is, well, there are many consequences of this, but some consequences is that we get the usual formulas for this thing here. And we also have a probability distribution of the experiment. So in conclusion, when we combine this point of constructing the Hilbert space and the result of the Born formula, we get the whole formula for time-independent quantum theory from more or less statistical arguments. What I needed basically was these two assumptions of focusing and symmetry. But I also needed some additional assumptions. I needed some assumptions of the group. And I needed some assumptions to prove the Born formula. But of course, there are many open questions in this, and I have only a very simple version of the Hilbert quantum mechanics, and there are many, as many of you have pointed out, there are many additional points that needs to be. And one open question is, which is interesting, is to make the coupling to data measurement theory, where we in statistics have a very simple coupling to data in a way, where we use these probability measures and estimate parameters and in quantum mechanics you have a big measurement theory where you take into account the interaction between the object and the measurement apparatus. I would like to see some connections here, but I don't know how to find them. So this is my end. I mean that quantum mechanics can be understood in terms of an extended statistical theory, where you make this extension, you look at focusing and symmetry, but not using simple statistical theory. That's well, I was very brief here. In addition to this, I had some technical assumptions with connection to the group and in connection to the Born formula. And I think these technical assumptions are very specific in a statistical connection, and that may be the reason why we don't see anything like that in
that question, how radical is it a departure to easily focusing into the standard system? It seems that it's essentially a sort of a constraint on what you can measure or not measure. How radical it is to use it into standard.
I mean, I gave some examples that you get something like that in using counterfactuals in statistics. Yeah. Hmm. Well, I think you may, but I simply don't know enough about it. Rob had a much more general setting. I don't know what you think about that, but I had a very simple argument for the violation of Bell's inequality. But is it too simple? Yeah, because of this. Well, I use the general statistical principle that when you do different experiments, then you should condition upon the particular experiment that you're performing. Yeah. Yeah.
Simply not met.
Yeah.
There are four different And there's no reason that we combine the probabilities in the way that in way we would if there were only one underlying experiment.
Mm.
And so anyway, you presented this as uncontroversial for statisticians,
which
I think is probably true.
Mm.
On the other hand, it seems like a controversial thing for physicists who are thinking that underneath the story of doing experiments, there's one underlying thing, some unknown, some random variable, of which the experimental process is just accessing and looking at. And that's inconsequential. Since it's inconsequential, people are inconsequential, observers are inconsequential, it shouldn't really make a difference for the ultimate description of what's going on. So when a physicist sees some kind of contextuality, it seems like strange thing, perhaps a controversy, instead of the statistician is not.
Mm.
So I don't really have a question, I'm just wondering if statisticians who don't take it as controversy, if they were really confronted with the idea that at the end of the day we couldn't find some unifying model underneath these four distinct contexts.
Mm-hmm.
If we really got to the point where you got this worldview where the context simply couldn't be believed even from the ontology, wouldn't that surprise a standard statistician?
Mm-hmm.
One last point. I say this because in the Bayesian community, I like much of what first guys do. They recognize that probabilities represent information and so forth. But then their natural inclination, most of them, if you go to magnetic properties, the natural inclination is to say, because quantum mechanics is about incomplete information, it must be about a hidden variable. And let us apply a hidden variable model. So it seems to me that most statisticians actually would find the idea of no underlying variable, the unifying of underlying variable, a kind of shock if they had just been immersed in the phenomenon.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even know how to respond to that.
No. I think you have an important point, but my feeling is that in the end, because we don't understand, either statisticians or physicists, we don't understand the thing, some of us get shocked and some of us do not get shocked, but in the end I think we should have an understanding where all of us get shocked at the same time.